speak to that. When I talk about interest, so when we're trying to develop our issues, you know, and when Ken had up there kind of as a watershed and different parts, so 140-some thousand, I'll say kind of the same thing. We got that. And then we've got a whole bunch of other comments out there as well. And so sometimes those are more helpful when you hear, but they're all relevant. They're all important to people, and it is a statement.
So if you add all this additional acreage to the timber base, what's to prevent there being requested for a revision of the plan, or when the plan mm-hmm. is revised yeah. and your timber base is expanded?
Yeah, so that's a very good question, and obviously continues to come up. So the forest plan, the planning rule, it's the same effort as like a roadless rule. So it's we're talking about, you know, laws and regulation policy. And so right now we operate under a planning rule that was completed in 2012. That's what guided the 2016 plan here. And so that's a process on how we go about to revise or amend the plan. It's a public process. And so to change the plan if this roadless came into play, we would have to or be either directed to or look at the plan. Most of the plans we look at are a 15 to 20 year planning effort. And so if we were to revise that plan, we would be going back and going through a public process and then taking about 6 or 7 years to do that effort. So the plans change, the plans evolve. This plan went through, I don't know what was 2008, the 16 amended. It's a big effort. That's how it would have to happen. At least under the current rules, and
that it would happen. It could easily happen if your timber base is increased.
So our timber base, yeah, the area of land that is, if the exemption went into the area, it adds what 185,000 acres that right now are not available to do that same harvest on. And I think 20 of those were going to go.
Becky, you were next.
Go ahead.
I've got a lot of questions. Well,
then.
So it might take the rest of the night. This exemption has been billed as not only for timber, but for other development projects like hydro mining and so on. That seems to be a red herring to me. And the reason being, they kind of waver between calling it an Alaskan exemption versus a Tongass exemption. I think the Tongass exemption is kind of a Freudian slip. The Chugach has 5.4 million acre Chugach has roadless areas as well. I forget how many.
5.4.
Yeah. Don't they have concerns about mining and roads and that kind of stuff? So in other words, if the roadless rule doesn't work on the Tongass, why does it work on the Chugach? If you're saying that these transportation projects mm-hmm. and so on can't proceed, and I would say that with the same for any other area in the national forest mm-hmm. system, it just is a complete red herring in my mind.
So now, and I don't disagree, like we've shared before, so the Chugach, yes, has several exemptions in the hydro project, so that the proposals that have come in to date have all been approved.
And you don't hear any protests from the Chugach, people in the Chugach, I've read a lot of comments, online. I don't think I've seen one about concerns on the Chugach.
Oh, there are strong advocates for applying the roadless to the Chugach as well. We're right at the end of the planning. It took 7 years as well, but we're right at the end of the Chugach planning process. And there are a number of interests out there. When we move forward, the state petition for the Tongass, the interest was in the Tongass. And so we couldn't there was a decision not to move forward. I'm relying on
probably more managerial, but the national forest by definition is multi-use, correct? So in this management program, you've got a set amount that you're going to, you would like to harvest every year if you could. The roadless just gives you more access, or if this roadless act was gone, you'd give you a little more flexibility of where you could go into. So the timber's coming off no matter what we're doing, in theory. So what we're talking about is extending roads, being able to access areas that we've already accessed before, make those timber harvests a little more economical, viable. And that kind of, in a nutshell, what it could do. And on the rider half or the upper half of it, it could make it easier to access.
It would provide an extra 185, the exemption would provide an extra 185,000 acres to operate on, to look at, that are not available under the...
Otherwise, the sales will become more expensive if we have to...
There's a lot goes into
it. Yeah, there's a lot to it, but in a nutshell, we're going to be harvesting a certain amount because it's multi-use. And it's not a national park, it's a national forest. So we're going to have a certain amount of mining, we're going to have a certain amount of recreational opportunities, a certain amount of timber harvest just by the mere definition, but a national forest. Otherwise, they had, way back when, they would have said, we're going to make it a national park, can't do anything now.
Right, for different degrees.
Yeah, I'd like to make a couple comments. One is, I think the fatal flaw here, your environmental impact statement, is not treating global climate change. A lot of things have been renewed. Even some of your own studies are saying that the highest and best use for old growth is in moderating climate growth. And to suggest that just because something's in the forest plan is a given or makes it right is not the case. So, and I think the public is getting that. They are really getting that. So in the 144,000 comments that you got, including form letters, how much attention was given to climate change? Why wasn't that such a big issue in the scoping? And I guess it's because you just say that, you know, you squeeze the toothpaste here and it comes out there or here and there. I don't buy that argument.
No, I appreciate the comment. I think at least the assumptions and that we're looking at is this is a programmatic, this rule itself does not, what do you say, does not
authorize
any timber sale or anything other than the rule on where that could operate at. But your comment, I get your comment regarding that.
Well, it's a standard and guideline in a way, isn't it? I mean, the rule. The fact that you have a roadless rule makes it a manageable.
Yeah, the roadless rule, it does. On area of the roadless, the characteristics that are there, it prohibits timber harvest, road construction, and road reconstruction within those areas.
Gentlemen in front.
Okay. I have a question. How long did it take to establish road rules for other states?
Mm-hmm. I'm going to lean a little on this guy. Do you recall? I think it was a couple of years in Idaho. I'm not sure in Colorado.
It was like 6 years in Colorado.
That's right. It
took forever. But the 2001 roadless rule was completed in 14 months.
Okay, and how much time will it take for Alaska to establish roadless rules?
So if this all goes forward, so what we're doing is looking to change the existing. Right now, the 2001 roadless rule covers the Tongass. And so the timeline that we have been working with would complete that rulemaking by next summer.
22 months from start to finish.
Okay, got the gentleman back.
Okay, so I'm going to try and combine a few things that I've heard tonight from most members of the audience. I'm trying to ascertain what the economic benefit of proposed option number 6 would be when, as previously stated, every exemption that has been proposed has been approved up to this point, is that correct? So like every economic development proposal or exception has been approved. Am I correct in saying that?
So let me qualify that like I did before. So everyone that has got to the point of the approval process, the decision making, has been approved.
Okay.
But I've heard there are a number of projects that folks feel do not get to that point. They get either derailed or somewhere along in the process.
So that frames my next part of the question. So I've heard in the slideshow the word opportunity a lot. However, I've also heard from people that right now, Petersburg specifically and a lot of southeastern Alaska relies mostly on tourism for its economic development. So what opportunity, when like considering this, how heavily did you weigh the current economic development through tourism as compared to economic opportunity that may or may not exist in mineral power and lumber harvest as compared to the potential detriments to tourism? So like more mines equals potential damage to viable ecosystems, more clear cutting or forestry harvesting, as far as I understand, leads to less available space for people like tourists to enjoy or potentially damage the ecosystems down the line. So what is the economic benefit of removing the roadless rule entirely as opposed to going by a case-by-case basis on approval process? Or has that been considered deeply?
There's multiple benefits, economic benefits for a full exemption alternative. There's the additional ability to connect communities, the ability to develop other energy sources such as geothermal, which is not allowed. We can't construct a road for geothermal within rural areas at this point. There's the mining thing that Dave was talking about. The removing the restrictions makes those development opportunities more attractive to investors. Really, it does, because they don't, because you know this, they don't want to invest in that kind of opportunity. The undersecretary at point blank asked us, what is the projection with or without the in terms of visitor use in the near future for recreational, with the visitor industry? And we had to be honest and say, well, we think it's going to continue to keep increasing. And so from a kind of a macro sense, from the way the policymakers look at it, is like, hey, your visitor industry is going to continue to increase. However, we're going to have adverse impacts to some parts of that recreational industry. But as a broad category, it's going to continue to increase.
Where did you quantify one adverse economic effect to another resource in that DEIS? There's not one.
We did say that there was going to be an adverse impact.
That there's adverse impacts and quantifying it for the public is two very different things.
Correct.
And you guys have not ever looked at economic trade-offs between resources.
We did a qualitative analysis.
It's a drive-by windshield survey.
You can look at it that way, but it's also very difficult to do a quantitative analysis when you don't know where we are authorizing any additional new activities. You don't know where they're going to be. You don't know when they're going to occur.
How about relying on the forest plan that you say is sacrosanct? Where is it there? Site one there.
We did look at it.
You looked at it, but I'm asking you for a quantifiable site in that DEIS or forest plan.
Okay, we'll have to get into that.
So back to
one on one.
You were next.
Yeah. Did that answer your question though? Because I don't think I quite finished there.
Not entirely. Kind of in a way it answered it, but not the way I was looking for, in that you said that there was no quantitative, that you only looked at the qualitative aspects of it, and that there may be more interest in economic development. However, that can't be proven in a quantitative way because you didn't look at the quantitative evidence. So it may or may not exist, just as the impact may be minor or it may be major, but it wasn't described, or at least in this presentation, it wasn't described in a quantitative way.
And we did not do a quantitative analysis in this.
Very surface level, qualitative, yes.
So that do that really fast.
I'm going to put you on the spot now, small room. And I'm sure you're expecting this, so you probably have a prepared answer. Regarding the 2016 Forest Service Washington DC office activity review, please don't tell me that it's outside the scope of this proposal. It has everything. It has number one prominence to do with this proposal. That activity review, you guys know what it's about. For the rest of the room, there were the Forest Service, a team of 10 specialists visited the Tongass in the summer of 2016, the spring of 2016. Specialists in their own areas, silvicultures, economics, appraisals, and so on. They found 18 formal findings of what they called maladministration. My viewpoint is that's a nice word for malfeasance. To name a few, they couldn't produce a whole copy of the big firm contract. They didn't implement the measures, the long-standing measures, to prevent timber theft. Directly related to why we're here tonight for the subsistence hearing is timber sale administrators allowed the contractors to cherry-pick NEPA-approved cutting units, thereby negating all of the years of work that the public, including many in this room, have participated in. All of those values are out the window, and who knows what the composition, structure, and function of those stands are now, because I don't know that there's, from all I can tell, there's been no analysis of what's happened on the ground. But the Forest Service, for 3 years, longer than it took the Mueller report, who interviewed people from foreign countries in the whole nine yards, the Forest Service has stonewalled and keeps telling us that they're doing an audit, and it'll be out and due out any day. We had a council or assembly member here almost a year ago, to the day tomorrow, say that he contacted an agency official who was, I thought, under a gag order to talk about it, but that particular agency official could talk to this assembly member, who also happened to be a former Forest Service supervisor, claimed that an audit would be out any day. That was a year ago. The Forest Service or the Assembly wrote you guys a letter and asked for some explanations. You didn't respond. The city clerk prompted you and said, hey, where is it? You didn't respond. 5 months later, May, I believe, we got a response. Or maybe it was April. We got a response and said, an audit is for us, an analysis is forthcoming, and we'll get back to you. Has that analysis been completed? And if so, why hasn't it been released to the public?
That's a long question. I will say I don't know the road list tonight, but I will answer the best that I can. One, I don't control the timeline of the audit. There has been an audit that has been conducted. It had not been finalized when I had been briefed about a month or so ago. It is close to being finalized. I don't control that timeline. I did, as I came in, I welcomed that audit, the Regent Forester. I was here when some of those things that the reviews had occurred, but I expect to hear soon, but I don't control that timeline.
There was $4 million worth of losses that were enumerated. I believe that that's probably just the tip of the iceberg. And I think it's a cover-up of monumental proportions. I think it's, don't mean to insult you, but it sounds like a lot of number cookings going on right now.
Okay. see that audit as much as we do, as soon as we can, and I do expect it relatively. I did check before I came here today. I thought that might definitely be a question, and I think within the next, I hate to speculate, within the next 2 to 4 weeks, we'll see that. Into Roseless, I'm not sure. So let's all look forward to the outcome of that audit. I know it is being, it's as close to finalizing as it can get, and I hope and expect that very soon.
Mike, you were next.
Mike Standard. I did see your hand a while ago.
In the Federal Register, that was printed about the rules, the proposed rules rule exemption, that was on 10/17. And it states that the USDA Forest Service, hereafter the Forest Services, manages national forest system lands to maintain and enhance the quality of the environment and meet the nation's current and future needs. I would like you to explain to me how the exemption would enhance the quality of the environment. And I would also like to ask you how it will meet the future needs, especially in the light of the science that's out on climate change.
So I fall back to the forest plan and how we're operating under the at this time. And when I look at how the roadless rule, if we overlay at least a preferred alternative or several of these alternatives, were something other than the exemption being selected, would, as you saw before, a variety of different interests that were in there would continue to sustain the health and diversity of our forests.
It says specifically enhance the quality of the environment. How does putting in more roads enhance the quality of the environment? Would you please explain that to me?
I think that was actually, I probably wrote it, but I think that was enhancing our other obligations for the nation, our multiple use mandate, which we do have a mandate to provide timber, regardless of the roadless rule, we have to do that. We have to develop minerals. We have a law that says that we're going to manage those and dispose of those. So, to meet those other mandates, we are, this rule will enhance our ability to do that. So I think that's what that was intended to say. You can write that right to the law. So does that make sense to you?
Sorry. Have you heard?
Rethink my question. You gave a date for a final decision on this? You gave a date for a final decision?
Yeah, I expect it's broad summer of next year, June, July of next year, 2020.
What can postpone that decision?
Well, lots of things. We always seem to get drugged down with a lot of things. It's an aggressive timeline. Depending on how and what kind of comments we get here during this effort and things, I know that there are lots that are concerned about headlines as well.
But you will be getting a lot of pressure to put that decision out quickly, right?
I guess I don't say pressure. I would say we were given a timeline by the secretary's office when we started, and then and it's within a two-year period, and trying to follow that.
4 months. Being optimistic, if we could postpone it a few months,
I got
pressure on the decision.
Thank you.
I got you. Mr.
Bash. I guess I'd like to get back to what Jackie said earlier about why the QDOT is fine keeping the roadless rule in place when basically we're all asking for us, right? And we're not. I mean, the only difference I see here is Alpine and Viking. So especially if there's been like, I mean, everybody that's asked for an exemption has gotten an exemption. I mean, I'm not saying hearsay, well, people decided the project wasn't good enough and they would never. I mean, of people that have gotten to that process, they've all been granted exemptions. So I don't see, I don't feel like you gave us a very clear answer on that.
But let me try again. Okay, so the two gaps, I worked on it for 18 years, revising the plan. There are a lot of resources on the Chugets. I got there in 1982. We were ending, our timber program ended when the most of the village corporations and regional corporations selected lands on the Chugach after Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. They were entitled to select, and they selected a lot of the timber base that was on the Chugach. There was a lot of historic logging on the Chugach up through the 70s and the 80s, but most of that timber base was conveyed over. We've got 90 miles of total road, I think, on the Chugach of National Forest System. So what the forest has is a lot of incredible scenery, a lot of rock, a lot of ice, a lot of recreation potential, recreation folks, different types of recreation. And so, in fact, the plan, there is no determination on, there is no what's suitable timber on the Chugach. So that's probably factoring into some of that discussion. Very limited. So most of, yeah, right now in here, we've got the industry has changed a lot since over the last 20, 30 years as well. Right now, Viking operates their mill in Kowak. They process about 22 million board feet a year out of that mill, and have for quite a few years. And Alcan has been working in the young growth arena and some old growth that they sell the Viking. But those are the two main. We've got another dozen or so very small operators, a couple in Goose Creek and Prince of Wales, and scattered throughout that mill a lot of its specialty wood value added products. So that's
but to follow up with that, Viking employs by their own numbers about 50 people, and Alpine employs about 50, and Viking Mill in Co-op employs about 40. So we're talking for 90 jobs. We want to exempt the Tongass from the roadless rule when everybody has pretty clearly said it's working. And that is the only difference I see between the Chugach and the Tongass. I mean, the Tongass is like 70% rock and ice and snow. Okay. I mean, the Chugach, yeah, it has more glaciers, but we're still talking about, you know, what could be most of those numbers when you talk about another 185,000 acres open for logging. You know, that's getting into the heart of what's left. And so that's, I'm kind of, that's what I'm seeing is the difference between the Tongass and the Chugach, is Viking and Alpine.
So one of the biggest differences, though, is the state didn't ask us to open up the Chugach. The state asked us to open up. The state petition just specifically asked the Tongass and didn't mention the Chugach.
And who is the state?
It was
Are
the
we not the state?
We're elected officials. We represent
their elected officials. We are the stockholders, yes. And you should never forget that.
Yes, I totally agree.
So let me finish the answer first before we get away. And we are. Maybe five more minutes or so before we've got a break for the hearing. We have people calling in, and that thing has to be timed. But you're right. There's not, I think Viking, you're citing numbers. They I think they employ 40 in the mill and another 40 or so in other jobs. And while that doesn't seem big, if you live in Kowak or Craig, it's in, you know, people there. Those are jobs that in a community that they feel very, very important. So I'm not defending or advocating one way or the other, but those jobs are important to some of those very small communities.
More important than the industries that are holding up the rest of the region.
So Matt, you were next.
You said that a big part of the secretary's decision might be that he was a governor and had the influence from our state government equal the input from 144,000, or maybe would you say that petitioning our governor and our state representatives now to pressure the secretary, would that be past its time for effectiveness in changing the outcome of this? If another public comment period is, you know, we send another 145,000 letters, but our state government elected officials here feel otherwise than what we do. Our efforts would be fruitful or wasted.
I would say that's amongst the group here. That's not something I would advocate one way or the other to lobby.
That's a rhetorical question.
I appreciate the question, and my comment was just as a gotten to know that.
No, I think you're probably right. But I mean, rather than pressuring just you, who are the secretary, I mean, I think that you're in the room that is hearing us and maybe letters back to our state government.
I have two different things. One's more like on that lines, and the other one's a comment related more to the AIS stuff. So, first of all, I recognize the difficulty of the position that you all are in, and I think that's visibly clear to everyone here tonight, even if you don't mind me saying that. So thank you for being here. And thank you for the tremendous amount of work and effort that was put into trying to develop the array of alternatives and follow through with what was said during the scoping period of trying to create something like unique and nuanced for the people of the region and everything. And it's nice to see those finally presented to the public. And the other things I've seen, there's been far less honesty in how we ended up in Alternative 6. So thanks for... But the EIS is already based on Alternative 6. The analysis is all based on Alternative 6. And normally when you're dealing with EIS, if this is the preferred alternative and everything's based on that, how is it potentially likely or possible that there's any other option? It kind of feels like all that work and effort kind of got through in the garbage, and we're sort of at this like all or nothing deal at this point. And then if you want to answer that, and then I'll go to the second
question. Let me try that one real quick.
Yeah.
So no, I would not say anything was wasted effort. Each of the rule that came in, one doesn't change all the analysis, skews one way or the other. Each of those alternatives were developed, and you're right, there was more work in some of those action alternatives than the other part. But there was also a draft proposed rule developed for each of those alternatives, am I correct?
Correct.
So each of those rules, you could go back and you can, and if you've worked with NEPA as a line officer, usually end up blending things from alternatives as long as they've gone through some analysis, they've been analyzed in the document. And so there's a rule for each one of those. So if things change, you can select another alternative that has been fully analyzed and has a proposed draft rule ready to go.
Thank you.
That makes sense?
Sure. Okay. And then there was that chart that said that all of the impacts were
minor
or similar or all the same. And you mentioned that again too when we got to the carbon stuff, because the amount of timber that's going to be taken out stays the same. And I think there's like a problem with the scale of how that's being looked at, because if you're viewing that whole bit in this big regional way that like everything's all created equal, that you could just pull from over here and throw it over there and that's fine and that all equals out, that almost seems very amiss from the truth on the ground in Southeast Alaska, that this is the whole Tongass is all these different islands and all these different places with different biological diversity, different ecosystems, different animals present, different species of plants. Like, you can't just substitute something over here to replace over there. But yet,
when you're looking at the economic stuff in the community, that's very like small and community centered. So why is the scale of the ecological impacts this great big regional thing that disregards the specific uniqueness of individual watersheds or individual islands versus this economic stuff that's based on the communities, and almost a suggestion or a critique that those impacts should at the very least have been looked at least on a ranger district level, if not going even more minute, to account for those differences in ecological diversity.
So, good question. I think that analysis is being very difficult for folks and us to explain and to work through on that scale. But I think it helps two things. One is one-on-one, or some time here is maybe walk through and pick this guy's brain on some of this. The other is, and I encourage all of you, when Ken put up there's a story map, one of the areas, because it's like this next 185,000 acres where we tried to put it on a map, you can't really tell on the scale. But that story map will allow you to drill down in your backyard and say, what's happening in Ann, and what's happening over here? And you can look and apply the layers of the different alternatives. And I think that really helps to at least to understand what those localized, what makes a difference.
Is there the possibility or the option to, at this point, dig deeper into that and break that down to like ranger districts or community impacts? Because I just came from all those subsistence RAC meetings, mm-hmm. and that like has strong impacts on subsistence for different communities.
Yes.
That are very different and unique.
Yes, and we are taking, especially the subsistence, we'll be taking these hearings, we're going to make some an A10 determination on the impacts to that, as much as we can.
So, folks, we got four more people, so if I call these people, please make it quick. We got is that all right, Dave?
Yes.
Yeah, so first, Mike, did you have something, Mike?
Yeah. Oh, Mike.
So, yeah, now I got a few minutes.
I guess my question was this is a top-down push.
So this is the responsible official, the person that makes the decision is the Secretary of Agriculture, unlike decisions we make locally here a lot from either the Forest Supervisors or Rangers. So that decision is held at the cabinet level of the
No, president. Well, I'm not really asking about the decision. I mean the push for the exemption.
Mistake.
Was this agency or was it started by the participants in the agency on the bottom or on the top?
No. So again, right from the very beginning, the state has asked the secretary, the governor, former Governor Walker, and now I assume Governor Dunleavy, have asked the secretary for an exemption to that rule. So that's what initiated the process.
Okay.
We're an agency. We go through the NEPA process. We try to do the best we can to provide that range of alternatives, but that decision is being made at that level, and that's where that came
from. Okay, thank you. Chelsea?
I understand this is happening within the confines of the mandate of the agency, so I'm curious about how we can change the mandate. Encouraging the mixed use, the facilitating all these different needs, like what does it take to get at that root? We keep not, but also talking about climate change and all those things come from the fact that the root of it all is something that was kind of set in stone a little bit ago before the effects on the ground are what they are now. And so I'm wondering how to get back to that.
So you say set in stone, you mean the preferred alternative?
Yeah.
The proposed rule.
Yeah. Talking about encouraging what we see as right now economic growth instead of what's actually really good for this region.
So that's what this is all about. I'm really hopeful is that, again, so we have a preferred, I've gone out with, we can't do that with this, but I go out with an EIS, we did a forest plan and like that. We did not indicate a preferred alternative. Got a lot better comments because people weren't trying to take one down or the other. I heard from people what they really wanted to see in that plan. It's got some drawbacks as well. In this case, we have a preferred that's indicated. And again, this is not me, but in my world, where I'm typically the final decision, doesn't always represent what we went out with as a like a trial balloon to folks. Now, that's the Secretary has indicated his preference. But we're here in the comments, what we've heard tonight, you know, we've all heard that. The IDT leader has heard that. We will get a lot of written comments. We will be rolling that back in, and that's between a draft. And so hopefully the final EIS will reflect what we've heard.
So real quick, Joe, and then Everett, that's the last two. Real quick, Joe.
A large part of the wide-scale public heartburn about this development exemption. A lot of people have been here for quite a long time, and we've been through the pulp mill, and we've been through the kind of malaise of the 90s, this thing for recouping. Then it went from the pulp mill and the little malaise to the log ships, and just get it out as fast as you can on the ship and gone. Take a picture of it because it's the last you're ever going to see it. We're talking about logs, valuable logs, hundreds of years old, some of them up to 500 or 600 years old. The Forest Service's management record, I'm afraid, having lived on Prince of Wales 25 of those years, is extremely poor. And you can't point the Prince of Wales Island and say, this is a poster child of what we hope to accomplish on the exemption lands. Because that's why everybody feels like you see the guillotine and the noose coming for places that you love and places a lot of people depend on. And in the last 20 years, have built businesses and jobs and all kinds of other, moved on. The rest of Southeast has moved on, except for the old times here, we got to keep filling the log ships. So that's where a lot of this grief, hard feelings comes from, because now, after you mismanaged three quarters of the Tongass for half a century or more, now you want mismanage another great big chunk that's just standing there like God made it. And that need no help from you or anybody else. It was here before any of us was even born. Those trees were standing there. And now we want to go take them down? That's where the heartburn comes.
Okay, thanks, Joe. Just one more. We're really running out of time, Joe. Ever, last one.
We are running out of time. Yeah. Climate change is coming down the pipe. We are running out of time.
Howard's been trying to get in. Let's comment.
I'm a little confused, I guess. seems like what you fellows have done is you spend a lot of time on the forest plan. And you said that whatever we do at the Rollers thing isn't going to change the forest plan. Is that correct?
Right.
So what we're really talking about on the Rollers thing, exemption and no exemption, is this where this can occur?
Yes.
It isn't going to occur. What occurs? It's just going to change where it may occur? Okay, that's my question.
So, thank you all. I'll be here if anyone one-on-one, and maybe Troy. I'm sorry, some of the hearing has to be right on time here, so we got about 6 minutes. If you haven't signed up and want to, let us, we're going to do, it'll be about 5-minute increments, and we'll, as we have time, we'll try.